Hey guys.
Hey Nick.
Which side of the cheetah has the most spots?
Which side, Nick?
The outside.
And Stranger Still.
Welcome to Stranger Still,
a podcast where we answer strange questions you never thought to ask.
I'm Nick Wood.
I'm John Beacon.
And with us today, we have an expert in the field. I wasn't sure what I was going to say before I started saying it.
Literally in the field, like out there under the sun. The tree, if they're tall enough.
Yeah.
Animal expert, David Endin.
Welcome to the show, David. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it.
We're excited to have you on our show today. David is literally an animal expert. I'm going to have him go over his qualifications here in a second. But today we're going to explore whether or not zoos are ethical, I guess. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah. Moral.
If they're moral, if they're okay to be around, because I've gone to zoos and I've enjoyed them, but while I'm there, I'm like, should I be enjoying this? So we're going to try to answer that question today. And David, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. So undergrad, got a bachelor's in science and conservation biology, did some work in Africa with big cats, did some work in Costa Rica with sustainable ecotourism. After undergrad, worked at a big cat sanctuary in Arkansas, fell in love, decided that I wanted to spend the rest of my life waking up to lions roaring. But there's always a lot of work and a lot more that can be implemented in the field of captive animal management husbandry. So I went back to get my master's at Colorado State in zoo aquarium and animal shelter management, did a thesis there on animal cognition and welfare, went to go implement some of these strategies in the field, had each person or each facility rather telling me that there wasn't enough money. So basically said, I'll be right back, and did an MBA in global social sustainability. So here I am now.
And that's where we are today.
So it's a new perspective because usually like when I think of waking up to the sound of roaring lions, I'm in my dreams and I'm covered in peanut butter. And it's a bad thing, but I see how you turn that into a positive in such a nice way.
Absolutely. Well, I was gonna say I literally just went to a zoo and I had never heard a lion roar in person, and they are so loud, like so much louder than you would imagine. So I'd be quite that would scare me to death if I woke up to that every day. So I'm glad someone's out there doing it. But you've kind of been all over the globe, seen a lot of animals, and certainly worked in literally in the field, as we said, walking the walk. So before we get into our show, I do have a little bit of history on zoos that I just wanted to go over really fast because I kind of found this fascinating. Do either of you want to take a guess as to where the first zoo was? John loves these questions.
Yeah, I'll let you take this because every single time it's always Egypt. It's always. Well, go on. Feel free to guess what you like, but he always gets me.
Bronx Zoo.
Close. It is ancient Egypt. The first
on the way there.
Yeah. Just on right on the highway there. No, the first zoo that we've been able to uncover was in 3500 BCE, if you will, and they've recovered like bones of hippos and elephants and baboons and those types of animals that were held captive.
I thought you meant the first zoo you personally have been to.
Oh, sorry. No.
Yeah. No. But yeah, ancient menageries go all the way back to ancient Egypt.
I'm also a time traveler, so it was the first zoo I ever went to.
Right. And it was also pretty, pretty bad for a zoo because it was only animal bones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
after that, though, in terms of, like you said, ancient menageries, there was a zoo of note in 1000 BC in China that was 1500. Acres, which seems pretty large, but I don't know if that's like I can't visualize that in my head, so I could be completely off. In terms of modern zoos, David, you might know this one as well. What's the first modern zoo that opened up that's still in operation today?
Ooh,
putting you on the spot.
Actually, yeah, I know. I'm not going to be able to answer that without Googling it.
There's the first modern zoo was Tiergarten Schönbrunn in Austria. It opened up in 1752. Still in operation today. They have over 15,000 animals in total, spanning 1,700 species. So it's
tip of my
quite
tongue.
Large. Yeah. That was your next guess. A little bit further, in 1853, we got our first aquarium as part of the London Zoo. That's always my daughter's favorite part of the zoo, is anything in water. And, of course, animals were treated horribly back in those days. They'd be behind iron bars on cold cement, and the zookeepers didn't care about their diet, so their diets would be horrible for them, take a toll on their body. They
were pretzels.
Or peanuts. They worked for peanuts.
Yeah.
Literally. Or they wouldn't have any room to move around. Like, one example I came across in my research is, like, we keep zebras in cages, and they're used to running miles and miles a day, or even elephants are used to walking miles a day, and they have to go around in circles, or they don't get to move at all. And things have come a long way since then, which we'll get into. And nowadays, at least in my unprofessional opinion, it seems like they're mostly in the businesses of education and bettering animals' lives. It's not so much back in the day it was like, hey, come check out my panda and pay me $100 a visit. All the zoos I've been to are super cheap, and lots of education resources like pamphlets and signs and all that stuff. All the enclosures are a lot bigger. They try to replicate the animal's natural environment, and I feel like things are continuing to improve. At least that's what it looked like in my research.
Yeah, so real quick before we jump into like legit
the fun
zoos,
stuff.
I have visited a ghetto zoo in Iowa.
Yeah.
You know about this one too?
Old McDonald's Farm?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, more ghetto than that, actually.
Beaver Zoo.
There's just some woman. Okay, so here's the story. Okay. Is I was...
We have to come back to this later, but go ahead.
Yeah, we'll come back to this later, too. We'll touch on home zoos. But yes. This woman, we went out and we were doing animal rescue, like just far, far away. And on the way back, I was looking at the map to try to get home. And there was like on the side of the road, something about a zoo. And we actually turned around, drove back, and pulled into this like barn. It was just a farm. Said that to get in, it was like, I don't know, 20 bucks total for both of us. We said, hey, we've got $5. She's like, all right, whatever. We were the only people there. We go into her house and it's just tanks filled with any reptile you could think of, like multiple snakes.
What?
One woman living there, and her house was like across. I went outside. She had a hyena. She had a bear.
What?
A lion. She had a donkey.
Can you do
five
that?
Horses? No, it's shut down now.
Okay, good.
It was horrible. All of them were in like cages you would buy at Home Depot. It looked like. And it was just like it was just very depressing.
Yeah.
And that was the last zoo I went to. Unfortunately, how sad. I want to go to a nice, good one.
Yeah.
But I'm glad this lady's at least shut down now.
Yeah.
Because she's had multiple warnings.
Well, just to circle back around, the first zoo that I did go to was the Minnesota Zoo. Went there like 4 years ago. That was a really good experience. They had bears, and I got to meet my favorite animal ever, which is the red panda.
Oh,
yeah. One of my favorites. And I don't know. I like zoos. And I hope I don't learn anything that really depresses me about zoos throughout this episode. I came across a few things in my research, but hopefully David just doesn't like crush me and break my hopes and dreams. Do you got any fun zoo stories before we get into this, Dave?
It's all fun. I mean, you're working with that. You're working with some of the most unpredictable, dangerous animals out there, really. And there's so much that goes into the daily care, you know, that most people don't think of. I could tell you a fun story that we're trained to do. We have something called the two-step back rule. You know the song, two-step, you know?
Yeah.
There's another song. So it's always in my head whenever I think about it. But even things like that, you know, you're trained first thing as an intern to take two steps back away from the enclosure before you turn your back, especially with the carnivores, because they'll just charge the cage and grab you. So there's a lot of interesting things that goes on in the daily lives.
Man, can't wait
zookeepers.
I can't wait to hear about it.
Yeah.
Well, let's hop into it, because as I kind of said before, zoos are getting better. They weren't always good. And as near as I can tell, the jury's kind of out on whether zoos are ethical or not. And I don't even know if we'll be able to say definitively in this episode, but we can at least give some context as to the different sides of things. So the first thing that I kind of want to know from your perspective is, what are some things that modern zoos are doing right? They're like nailing it.
So education is a big one. Mm-hmm. You know, the great thing about a zoo is for people in the U.S. that cannot afford to fly to Africa and see a lion or see an elephant,
yeah.
Instead of paying, you know, $2,000 to $4,000, they can pay $20 to $40 and go visit these animals.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to see them, you get to become educated on them. So education is something that they're definitely doing pretty well. In terms of reintroduction
mm-hmm.
and conservation, you got to look at the numbers. So there's a lot of things out there, a lot of programs out there that zoos use to help with conservation in the wild and repopulating the wild.
Yeah.
So first off, I just want to throw some terminology out there for
Perfect.
Our listeners. And the big thing that you always want to look for from a zoo is, are they accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums? And this is the regulating or governing organization for legitimate zoos. And part, we call it AZA. Part of AZA is to conduct a species survival plan. We call it the SSP. And what they do is they are breeding in captivity to release back into the wild.
Yeah.
And it's very regulated. The stud books are actually published. So while I was at Colorado State, I was doing a paper on cheetahs, and I was looking at literally the individuals, which individuals were bred with whom and from what zoo and where they went after that.
So there's numbers work involved too, right?
Correct. A lot of genetics. And wow. And the hope is to one day reintroduce them into the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's about 500 species that are under the SSP program, and they've had about 8 successful reintroductions, depending on your definition of successful.
That's one question I was going to ask you, because I had read in one article, I don't know how old this is, and I also don't know their definition of success stories, but they said that there were 145 zoos that tried to, like, reintroduce into the wild. And there's only been 16 success stories, which is still an incredibly low number. I'm guessing their definition is a little bit looser. So are there things that, I guess I don't even know what the process really is, other than you said there's like breeding and stuff, but how long do they monitor them afterward?
Right. So I think what you're getting at is a big issue is nature versus nurture.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you an example. Working with cats, I've seen right by a tiger, and I've seen a rabbit run in front of the tiger,
mm-hmm.
freeze in fear.
Oh, no.
The tiger walked up to it, sniffed it, whacked it, and went on its way. So, you know, there's a lot of things that these animals learn that they need to learn in the wild.
Right.
And so like the love. Trick is like love and care and where to get a drink. And the trick is, you know, how do you simulate captivity? The Amur leopard, they're having great success. What they do is they take the individuals from zoos and they bring them over to Russia, and they have this completely fenced off area where mm-hmm. no one can see in, and the leopards can't see people, and they have these chutes that they'll release live prey from.
Oh, okay.
You haven't heard of this because it's live prey, and you know everybody would.
No one likes that.
Yeah, no one likes that. But in this process, you're teaching the animals how to survive on their
it's
own.
It's necessary. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, and they have little video screens, and they show the animals, the live prey, committing crimes. So yes. They're only hurting the bad ones.
Right. They only capture the bunnies that held up a bank and
stuff like that.
that are eating up your garden. They take those.
Yep.
Yeah. Exactly. I spent years on those carrots, you jerk.
Exactly.
I know that just like personally, and I feel like collectively, a big concern with zoos is whether or not the animals are treated fairly or ethically. So you said that there's a governing body. Can you say that name one more time? Because I only remember the initials AZA.
Sure. It's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
Awesome. Perfect. Are there, like, how often do they quality check these zoos and make sure that they're treating their animals right?
So they're highly, highly regulated. You can't be accredited if you're not abiding by their standards.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the members of an AZA zoo, they're sensitive to treating the animals well, to providing them with optimal care.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a huge organization, and so public scrutiny is very damaging, you know,
right.
Going to the business side. So highly regulated, you know, there's a conference once a year. And they actually are, a lot of the zoos now sharing their daily information digitally. So it allows zoos to have entire computer software programs dedicated just to the SSP and to diet and to zoos that are now connected around the country. So in terms of feeding and veterinary care, that's pretty universal throughout.
Yeah, that's got to be a good step for technology in terms of zoos, because I guess before, back in the day, you'd probably write it on a piece of paper, and then when you transfer an animal to another zoo, you're like, oh, this is what we found out about their diet. Have fun. Whereas now it's like, I assume there's a repository, like, what do tapirs eat? And they can all dump all this data into whatever system and communicate with
And not only that, but if it's publicly available, that's incentivizing for businesses to look it up and say, okay, they're legit.
Yeah, absolutely. Customers. Yeah,
that's what's great about. I always tell people. My mom the other day, she sent me an email. She said, "Research this. I want to donate to them." And because people don't understand that, you know, all nonprofits have to have their financial information. It's called a Form 990, and it has to be available online. And the first thing you should always do when you learn about a new nonprofit is make sure that they're putting their money where their mouth is, and that's what that allows you to do.
Yeah.
So how much are they spending on animal care, how much are they paying their employees, how much is going to conservation? It's all really important.
I will say, after our PETA episode, that's become a hobby of mine, is to look into nonprofits' tax forms. Because I've done this for a couple nonprofits now. It's really interesting, because you can certainly see where they're trying to fudge some numbers, like, this went to advertising. But in reality, it went to some schmuck who's like running a program or something.
I ate six buckets of salmon as a CEO. That was my share.
Yeah. So that's always really fun. So we talked about like reintroduction into the wild, but I also want to know how zoos get their animals these days. Because when I mostly just looked into the history, I did a little bit of modern research, but back in the day, they would just like go and take them from the jungles of Africa, and all of a sudden they had this wild animal in captivity. Is that still the case?
So now for zoos, aquariums are a little iffy, but for zoos, they all follow the captive bred protocols for 99.9% of their animals. Mm-hmm. Some animals just don't breed well in captivity. That's sort of a door that we don't really open. But so that goes into, again, the species survival plan. So everything's well documented and published. The stud books are published. But then it goes back to the question of successful. So, you know, we were talking a little bit about it before, and I am always interested in this concept of efficiency versus effectiveness. So as a sanctuary, we can be effective and rescue a lion, but if that lion is suffering from arthritis and we're not implementing the technology and knowledge to give it a better quality of life, then that's not really efficient. We're not doing all that we can.
Right.
So to bring some numbers, if you look at this quote-unquote successfully reintroduced SSP animals, you have about seven species. Mm-hmm. Now, one of those species is the black-footed ferret, and I have a major beef with the black-footed ferret.
Uh-oh. There's some history here.
Yeah.
Well, they are listeners, so it's just so you're aware.
Yeah, just be careful around that subject.
Well, it's more of just a numbers. So it's not that anyone's doing anything wrong, but what I would like to know is, if we're repopulating, to me, a successful reintroduction is the animals are sustaining wild populations.
Yeah.
Now, with the black-footed ferret, where I was just in Colorado, you have development that is causing a scarcity in prey, and then you have something, you know, so that's a solvable problem. Mm-hmm. We can create protected areas and conservation land. The issue I have is plague, and so plague is in the soil, and it's a major threat to the black-footed ferret.
Like the black plague? The bubonic plague?
It's not the bubonic plague, but it is a disease that causes that decreases survival rate in the black-footed ferret.
Okay.
And so the thing is how do you fight that?
Mm-hmm.
So from what I was told when we toured their facility is, you know, that plague was introduced here as we moved west. So how do you successfully introduce a species that is not going to maintain stable populations in the wild without you continually spending money to reintroduce into that population?
Right. And like you said before, there's never enough money. So who's going to continue funding?
You can't breed some genetically modified black-footed ferrets that are immune to this plague with your science money.
With your science money.
And that was my, I did a TEDx CSU last year. And at the end, I closed with those numbers, but for tigers. So mm-hmm. we have never released a captive tiger into the wild. There's 400 or more tigers in the SSP program. Okay. So that's an annual cost for one tiger is about 10 grand. So you're talking about $4 million, right? So that annually. And so that was me just doing some simple math. And then you can go onto LandWatch or Google, you know, properties in Russia, and we can be purchasing and protecting enough land each year mm-hmm. for 6 to 12 tigers. So that's this idea of effectiveness versus efficiency,
yeah.
you know, and that's something that zoos are going to have to come to terms with, especially now with social enterprises, market-based solution, conservation, investing. Mm-hmm. Those are real things that are having a very high success rate in their implementation throughout the world.
Wow. I'm like speechless. This is the moment of the show. This has happened a few times before where I'm just like so interested that I forget that I'm doing a show and I have to keep it moving along. So I guess kind of to your point, in terms of effectiveness versus efficiency, where do you feel zoos are falling short the most? that makes me worried.
Yeah, I'm big on welfare. Uh-huh. We have so far to go in terms of understanding the animal mind, mm-hmm. and it the good thing is that most of these things are going to be simple fix. Simply fixed.
Yeah, like you said, welfare. We got to get those tigers off of food stamps.
Stop it.
Exactly. You know, give me a whole chicken. I don't want a drumstick.
Right.
but really, to me, it is the welfare part. Mm-hmm. But that goes right back to the money. And right. So the reality of it is, as much as I love animals and as much as all I want to do my whole life is help animals, is you can't help animals unless you have the money to do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. So I think that concurrently, they have to increase welfare while having more sustainable business models.
Yeah, I will say. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of people, I was just going to plug in, a lot of people don't understand what I mean by welfare. So, and what I mean by the animal mind. Mm-hmm. Franz De Waal is a leading researcher in this and has a great book, which everyone should read, called Are We Really Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Really Are? Long title.
Yeah, but it's succinct.
Yeah.
Right. And so long story short, we tend to anthropomorphize. Mm-hmm. So root word anthro, we tend to take human based emotions and put them in an animal's head. And so that has a severe issue when you're trying to figure out what that animal needs. So a tiger, for example, in captivity, a lot of keepers will tell you we put new objects and scents in their enclosure to stimulate them like mm-hmm. that you would in the wild. As a lion is patrolling its territory, which is one of its primary functions throughout the day, besides sleep, eat, and mate, top life.
The normal functions.
Yeah. They'll come across things that have moved through the area. Mm-hmm. But we still see stress-related behavior in captivity. And there's some preliminary studies that are suggesting that big cats, the only cats that can roar, that spend most of their day patrolling their territory, space is big for them. Mm-hmm. Whereas a grazing animal, like you said earlier, like a zebra, their stress-related behaviors, such as licking and chewing and pacing, that may be because, like you said, they don't have enough space, right?
Yeah.
But that could also be an anthropomorphic view.
Yeah.
So it may not be that there's not enough space, but it may be that their feeding habits aren't right. So if they're used to eating all day long in the wild, and then they get fed three or four times in the zoo. Yes.
Yeah.
Or worse, you know, vegan. Those freaking vegans that feed. I mean, I'm a vegan myself, but there are people that do that to their pets and they're evil.
Give them a natural diet.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, especially, like, I didn't plan this, but we did go to a zoo this weekend, and a lot of things, I got to talk to one of the employees there, I don't know, she was sitting outside the lion cage, and they had a new litter of lion pups, cats, what are they? They're not pups.
Cubs. Chicago.
Cubs. you would think I would know that. She was talking about how one lion was roaring because she missed her sister, and like she was looking for her sister and stuff. And that's like so anthropomorphized. You're exactly right. I kind of do want to hone in on like how our enclosures affect the animal's life and their behavior, because I came across, like, I didn't really understand the context behind some of these, but like if elephants are I don't know, to give a human word to it, depressed or something, they'll start bobbing their heads and stuff, or cats will excessively groom. Is that a thing?
Yeah, so we call them stereotypies. Stereotype behaviors, stress behaviors, all mm-hmm. the same thing. And it's usually exerted out when the animal's stressed. So for humans, a big thing is jumping the leg up and down in a meeting underneath the table. There's actually, if you want an amazing book, this book called What Everybody Is Saying, like everybody. Mm-hmm. And we do that too.
Yeah.
And you can see those. So a big one with the cats is the pacing trails. You'll see that they're walking the same area. You'll see them. I'll never forget. And it was another sanctuary. And I Game of Thrones them and took out the shame bell and started throwing food at them. But they
good for you.
Yeah, they posted a picture. You want to talk about anthropomorphism? They posted a picture of a tiger sucking on its tail, which means it is very upset.
Yeah,
and said, "Look how cute so and so is being today." And I was just like, "That's miserable. Shouldn't even post that,
man."
Interesting. So, but that's what I mean by welfare. Is it's not that zoos aren't doing it; it's that we're at this time where we have a ton of information and we need to start putting it into play.
Yeah,
and what we thought we knew is, you know, 180 from what we know now. So I was talking about a research project that I did while I was writing my thesis. Is I came across this article of three different giraffe subspecies. Mm-hmm. So they have evolved for thousands of years in a specific ecosystem. And it was the Maasai and two others. Mm-hmm. And they did a study in 200 zoos by tracking the licking and the pacing. And they found that the two other subspecies paced and licked more. And so, again, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, well, they need more space. But if you look at what we call evolutionary psychology and you go back and you say to yourself, you know, well, what kind of an ecosystem did that animal evolve in? Or if you don't believe in evolution, what kind of ecosystem was that animal made to perfectly exist in?
Yeah.
And so the whole theory was, it's called optimal foraging theory. So it's the amount of energy that an animal will exert to get their food every day. And the Maasai live in a very vegetatively dense area. Mm-hmm. So it's like going up to a buffet.
Right? They had no effort exerted.
Mm-hmm. No effort, right? And then when you look back at the other two subspecies, you know, the hypothesis was that they're probably in arid environments. So mm-hmm. it's like going to the grocery store, coming home and cooking your own meal.
Yeah.
Right? So they have evolved or been created to exert energy all day to get there. Mm-hmm. Now, back to captivity, you know, the anthropomorphic answer would be they don't have enough space. But if these two subspecies only get fed five times a day, then it's much more likely that they're stressed mm-hmm. because they're not feeding all day long. And so this is where things get interesting, because like you said, we've created these enclosures to mimic their wild habitats, but that may not be the case. With the two subspecies, you may simply need to take PVC pipe and lay it all throughout the enclosure and fill it with food each day so that they're spending all day trying to get their food.
Yeah.
So that's where we are in terms of enclosures right now. Is to say that its size is anthropomorphic. With the cats, they're in their entire, the big cats are in a whole different genus because of their ability to roar and their adaptations to needing space. Mm-hmm. The elephants and some of these herds that take the great migration, you know, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But for a primate, space, I mean, they need to just be mentally stimulated more than anything.
Yeah. So we live in America where we solve all of our problems.
I'm already worried with where you're going.
No. This is a well-versed and well-researched thing that I had to get out. We solve all of our problems with drugs, right? So I'm sorry to interrupt you so soon, but I did have to say that this episode is brought to you by Elephant Grade Zoloft. and big fans of the show, big sponsors. Yeah. The pharmaceutical industry loves us. Okay, you could go on. I just wanted to put that in there.
The sad thing is sometimes animals, pets, and captive wildlife do need some of those.
Yep.
Yeah.
But again, do they need it, or are you suppressing something else, that they need?
Yeah. So that turns into, you could have the same debate with humans, with drugs. And
yeah,
I wonder if that's something like legitimately that would affect them and how that's controlled too.
I bet, yeah. This is like...
We could do an entire podcast on
that. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. Like, this is the whole idea of the animal welfare caught me off guard a little bit, because I kind of expected the answer of like, what's bad about zoos to be like, oh, some of them don't treat their animals right, but then we have that governing body that makes sure they treat them right. I never thought of like, why is this animal sad would be so complicated and so fascinating. Yeah. I can see why you love it.
Yep.
Like, yeah. It's so...
And the answer isn't throw more space at it. It's what did they used to live like?
Yeah. And you can't like you said, you can't say across a species, it's always going to be they need more space, or they need this type of food, or they need stimuli. It can change from from species to species, but within a genus, right?
Right.
So that's complicated. I love
yes.
it. That's so fascinating.
So the good news is that zoos are they're making move is mm-hmm. a good slang way of saying it. They can't move that fast because it's just one big circle. It comes down to funding.
Right. So support your local zoos. I had one more question, and I don't know if this is too broad, but if I'm going to a zoo, besides John's story, what are some warning signs that this might not be the best zoo, or they're not treating their animals maybe the best? Like, what can I look out for?
Well, when they say, oh yeah, it's $5, that's fine, I could do that, that's a good sign that you should leave.
Yeah. Hey, I will say, the zoo that I went to over the weekend, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but it was only like $12 to get in, and it was a big zoo.
Did she also offer to make you a sandwich and she was the only employee?
No, it looked incredibly professional. It was in someone's backyard. The employees were really knowledgeable. But back to the question.
Yes, go. We don't mess around.
No worries. You've actually been hinting along several ways that you can make sure that you're supporting the right zoo throughout our talk here today. Mm-hmm. So the first big one is obviously making sure that they're part of the associations of zoos and aquariums. Mm-hmm. That should be right on their website. If not, the AZA has a website that you can check.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that we can touch on real quick is the government, the USDA, the animal, the APHIS, the Animal Plant Health Inspection. Mm-hmm. That's the S stand for service. I'm not sure. USDA APHIS division, they monitor the Animal Welfare Act. And everyone gets inspected, surprise visit once or twice a year. And until Trump president,
you don't have to be worried. We've said many times we're not fans of Trump on this show, so yeah, don't be worried about it.
We're into evolution, nope. And we're not into him.
Yeah, go on.
No, well, he never evolved. That's his problem. Yep.
He's still orange.
Yes. So the orangutan. So the Animal Welfare Act, you have the right to have a copy of it. We call it the Blue Book. I just opened it right now. And it's an interesting little book. But before Trump was president, I haven't checked in 2018. But when a lot of the government sites shut down, this was shut down too. There used to be a database where you can check every zoo to see if they had any citations against mm-hmm. animal welfare regulations, which is important because they're incredibly vague. But John, I believe I said we'd get back to this, and I think this is the point you're getting at, is you have to be careful about roadside zoos.
Yep.
Yeah.
And roadside zoos were a great thing back in the day, but they cannot pull in enough money and do not have the infrastructure within their organization to really provide optimal welfare and care for the animals.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they are governed by no one but APHIS. And let me tell you something. Without telling you which ones, I've done internships and research in a lot of zoos, and I was at one zoo during an inspection by APHIS, and they barely passed through it. If I could just read, I sent Nick over more sort of an excerpt, but this Animal Welfare Act, and for every animal except for non-human primates and marine mammals, you know, the space requirements, it says that the enclosure shall be constructed and maintained so as to provide a sufficient space to allow each animal to make normal postural and social adjustments with adequate freedom of movement.
Yeah, that's very subjective.
That's what I was going to say. Like, that's, how do you interpret that?
And that's the issue. So
depends on what that guy ate for dinner that night before he went on his
right.
inspection. Yeah. Mood.
You know, AZA is a lot more regimented in terms of their requirements,
mm-hmm.
whereas the roadside zoos have that in terms of space.
Yeah, interesting.
So look for AZA. Mm-hmm. You can look at the Form 990s. And, you know, I don't think it's unfortunate because roadside zoos mean well. But, you know, in 2018, $18 admission, they need to be charging like $50 to $100 admission as a private entity.
Yep.
Yeah, interesting.
So,
yeah.
I don't know how this woman was affording to do what she did. But
by having it on her house property.
It was nuts. But I feel like the most, if you want to have some kind of roadside animal attraction, go with something manageable like a horse stable.
Or tarantulas.
Or tarantulas. Your tarantula farm.
Then you just kind of segue into another issue with zoos, and this is a whole other podcast, but, you know, then there's, well, what about animal attractions? Because I'm going to say, everyone's going to be upset, but, you know, SeaWorld, as somebody very passionate about animal behavior and welfare,
mm-hmm.
do organisms with culture and language belong in captivity? Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then the catch-22 is that attraction and that business has way more money than most captive animal facilities will ever see, and they contributed 1 to 3 million a year in marine mammal rescue. So, you know, that's the thing that zoos have to deal with now, is they can no longer exhibit their animals for entertainment, which did bring in the money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And how do they create ethical, sustainable revenue streams to fund their operations?
SeaWorld sound like they got their business model from PETA.
I know.
Yeah.
If you have the most money and you're the loudest voice, it doesn't matter what the hell you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a tough issue, because that's, I think, the crux of the whole thing is there's not, I guess maybe the tides are changing. I feel like they might be, where not a lot of people want to go spend their weekend learning something, go to a zoo and learn about camels or tigers or sea lions or stuff like that. Like, how do you make a business out of that? Whereas you could have these sea lions bounce balls on their noses, and that's going to bring in a lot more people.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think conservation financing and market-based solutions are really the answer, because they're business models that are designed with the three tiers of sustainability, or the three principles of business, which is planet, profit, people. So you have people in there, you have profit in there, and you have your, you know, environmental cause for the planet.
As far as entertainment value goes, where you want to actually engage kids and engage mm-hmm. adults in being genuinely interested in the animals, but you don't want to like train them to do anthropomorphized things that are garbage, like, oh, look, a bounce ball on its head. Well, maybe it's better at that, but still, if you want to attract them genuinely, have you noticed that there's been a push for software, like for kids bringing their iPads to the zoo, and as you get to an enclosure?
Well, I'll say, like, they have those at the zoo, where they have, like, interactive displays inside or at the aquarium or whatever for kids to play with. I know that.
I wonder if that's become mobile more, or if that's something that is not.
I wrote a blog on this. It's my cheap way of patenting, I guess. when Pokemon Go came out, all the zoos were having a field day, because they were getting a lot of business because all the Charizards were over in the zoo, right? But the thing is, you're absolutely right. Like, a big thing with nonprofit conservation is a lot of these businesses are fighting the massive change that we are facing now in society, as within this digital era, this digital revolution. We had the industrial, this is the digital. And yeah, John's absolutely right. I think that you know
copyright.
Yeah, but write me down there too. But they should have apps, you know. And, you know, you're talking business, so have an app where they have to go and they scan the little barcodes at each exhibit, and mm-hmm. they have to collect each, and then, you know, the kid gets a free ice cream if they collect 50, and if they collect 100, dude, they get a free visit back. I mean,
are you kidding me? I would do
money.
That for free ice cream.
Let's cancel the podcast and start designing this.
All right, we'll work on that after the show.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, like, there are people out there like myself that if they bring in a cool animal, it makes me excited to go there. Like, the Minnesota Zoo just got kangaroos last year. I was like, oh, hell yeah! I want to see some kangaroos! Come on! So, I mean, there is a certain market for that. I'll just speaking personally.
Yeah, absolutely. It's when you look at the industry reports of the amusement park recreation, which zoos don't have their own industry in the NICS codes, the industry reports. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at amusement park and rec, every time there's a new attraction, it's like, what was that movie? Jurassic World.
Yeah, Jurassic World.
They, every time there's a new asset, you know, revenue goes through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a big deal. And it's great that people are allowed to, you know, travel to see that instead of going all the way across the world.
Yeah.
Yep. I posted in our Facebook group. That's where we're most active. Yeah. So if you're listening, you should go to facebook.com/groups/strangerstill. Yeah. But I asked if anyone had ever been starstruck by animals. Like, oh my God, a giraffe. I've seen you on TV.
Yeah. Oh, I had that with kangaroos. Like,
yeah, I'm sure you did. Yeah. I've seen you in movies.
Yeah.
Love Kangaroo Jane, Kangaroo Jack. Yeah. Just been the best film.
Ever.
Nick loves it. He's got it. He's got 7 VHS
That's
copies
not true.
Of Kangaroo
That's
Jack.
Not true. It's 6, but thank you.
Yeah, so we had a lot of people engage in there and say that that's something that they felt too.
That's
and
exciting.
I could see how that could be a revenue thing.
So yeah. I think we should answer the question once and for all. Are zoos ethical? And I feel like just in what you've said in my research, I don't feel like there's a lot of things besides roadside zoos that they're doing wrong anymore. Like they're trying their best. Maybe some animals aren't getting the best treatment, but I feel like they are on the good side of the ethical scale.
Yeah. So
am I wrong?
David, I feel like you'll have an actual, legit, passionate answer for this.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead. You first, John.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's for me, it doesn't seem so black and white. If you've got that problem with the numbers where, 140-something cats, and then 14 were successfully reintroduced, it becomes a necessity to keep them healthy and happy in captivity as best you can. And as long as you're pursuing that, there's a gray area in the middle where it's like, this is something that's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But you go.
Yeah, I get asked this question a lot, and I think I just wind up talking more. So I think, and this is going to sound, I guess, kind of poetic, I always wanted to work with animals because it would be cool. And then I started working at a sanctuary, and sanctuaries are much different than a zoo, right? They're not there for conservation. They're not there for entertainment or education. Sanctuaries are there because John Smith down the road decided he wanted to have a pet tiger and, you know, got it for $300 as a cub and couldn't take care of it anymore, neglected it. And so now it needs a second chance at life.
Right.
And so that's when I shifted what I wanted to do in life to working for animals. And so I think to that, I will never truly answer the question of are zoos good or are zoos bad, because it's what we call a wicked complex. That's actually a textbook term, a wicked complex.
It was invented in New Jersey. Boston.
Yeah. A wicked complex problem.
Yeah. It's wicked hard. I get it.
Yeah. That's it. It's hard to solve. So, but, you know, to me, it's just you need to work for the animals. And so they need optimal welfare. You need to be deploying strategic and sustainable conservation actions in the wild. And you need a business model that's going to be able to support all that. So to say, I could say, oh, well, because of what I told you about, you know, the animal mind and cognition, zoos are horrible.
Right.
But they're doing the best they can with what they have. And they're moving forward, you know, where you have some roadside zoos that are inbreeding tigers and creating ligers and tigons and all this crazy things. Like, you know, a rescue we did a couple years ago, we got there the first day and they, you know, they were breeding white tigers, and I walked into the room and there's these 4 white tiger cubs and all their bones were shattered because they're so inbred. You know, that is just plain black and white wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it is wrong. Zoos, I think that they will continue to evolve. I think that they're moving forward, which is most important. But just like anything else, there's room to improve. coming Absolutely. From Colorado in a sustainable state with modernized business techniques and coming back to New York, I want to kill myself because there's so much room to improve.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Bronx Zoo. I used to go there as a kid like twice a year.
Yeah.
So you want to know about a role model. I mean, they're it and everything that they do, everything. So, good.
Well, I have a couple like oddball questions. They're not related to this at all.
Sure.
So do you want to take a quick break? We'll tell people where to find us and then we'll come back and I'll ask you these really weird questions.
We need something to keep them to come after the break, Nick. That's like a hook. Like, for example,
you get to listen to us talk.
How high do the animals get in Colorado?
No.
Medically.
So John, where can people find us?
You can find us at StrangersToTheShow.com.
Yep, and if you want to interact with us on social media, the best place for that is Facebook, like John said before. Facebook.com/group/... Oh my god, it's so hard to say. /StrangersStill.
You know what, Nick?
Yeah.
I'll add a link to our site.
Okay, that's a good idea.
I added a big, giant red button at the top of our site where you can become a Patreon supporter.
Yeah.
That helps us get behind paywalls and have better research and better information for you.
Yeah, we're not always going to have an expert on our show. Sometimes it's just me, so... You got to help us with those paywalls. I don't want to put you on the spot, David, but if people want to ask questions to learn more, would it be cool if they put it on our Facebook page and ask you directly?
Absolutely. I'm adding you now, so they should just be able to tag me right in there.
Awesome. Sweet. Perfect. So, David, if you want to interact with him,
I have one rule.
Yes.
So, quick tangent for the rule. This is like many of the topics you cover. It's an emotional topic,
mm-hmm.
and I love answering questions. But no question to help animals is answered in a heightened emotional state. So the one disclaimer is I get a lot of trolling.
Yeah.
Word. Yep. I won't answer.
Good.
Can I add rule number two that I found is just the most effective rule of all time for question answering?
Go ahead.
Don't ask a question if you would not be interested in hearing someone else ask that very question.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
You guys should put these on your site. Rule number one.
Yep. We'll put them up. Our group usually only trolls me, so I don't think that they'll troll you.
Yeah. I joined in on it.
It's usually my brother or... Yeah. But I have
some troll on there now.
Great. I can't wait.
He's already approved.
Yeah. So I have two questions for you and maybe three. I don't know if I'm going to ask the third one. My first question for you is, what in your opinion is the coolest zoo? That could be like the best zoo in terms of ethics. It could be like has the coolest animals. What do you think?
Coolest zoo.
In the Bronx, I do want to add, they do all wear sunglasses, all the animals.
I'm going to be a little bit biased. I've been to a lot of zoos, but I think the Bronx, I'm just so for the Wildlife Conservation Society and the Bronx Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just have so many species. I think the way they present the species is great. They always have volunteers or docents there to answer your questions. They have keepers there doing keeper talks. And, you know, even when you visit the little sections, they have the food and shops to theme. I think it's a great way if you want to have an experience of what's Africa like or what's Asia like. Mm-hmm. I think they do a phenomenal job. They do a great job in their transparency, and yeah, it's a great time to go there. It's a horrible car ride in. It's an absolutely miserable car ride in. But what they do there is great.
Isn't it like right off an exit, if I remember? I don't think I've ever been old enough to drive there myself. I think I was always driven when I was a kid.
I you always go during the day, and then
it's always packed. Yeah,
you get on the Cross Island, and then it's all downhill from
which
there.
Which is New York bonding right now. Just a little driving talk, a little traffic.
Yeah.
I'm from the Midwest, so I don't get any of this. All of our zoos kind of are not the greatest.
Yeah.
Columbus Zoo is cool. That's out by you guys.
Yeah.
Right?
9 hours away.
Maybe.
So I'm almost weary to ask this question. This is a question I wasn't going to ask, but I do want to know, in your experience, what was the worst zoo you've ever been to? You don't have to name names if you don't want to, but I just want to know like what the experience was like.
For overall or for the animals?
Either one or both. Up to you.
They were both roadside zoos.
Yeah.
One was during a rescue, and these animals, they were living in dog kennels, you know, and emptied out pools is where some of the bears were living. And I think that the guy meant well, the community loved them.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, they're in the middle of nowhere, and I felt safe. You know, the other one I'll tell you about, didn't feel so safe. But yeah, I mean, when you can't see, that's always another rule of thumb for the listeners. If you can't see grass, that animal is pacing so much that it's just destroying the ground.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why an enclosure should be really mud.
Yeah.
Yep.
Unless dirt. It's like a turtle.
Or my backyard, because I have 7 dogs.
Yeah. I was going to say, unless it's my back. Yeah, same thing. So
they just tear the grass, but...
But then there's another place that, and these are sort of the ones that trick people. My boss, he's the main star in the documentary on the exotic pet trade, Elephant in the Living Room, and that's on Amazon Prime right now, I think.
All right, I'm going to check that out. Prime.
It's really good.
Cool.
His name's Tim Harrison, and he was my mentor, and he always used to say that common sense isn't so common anymore. And the zoos that really get you are the ones that are so hands-on with their animals.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason to be hanging out with a tiger. There's no reason. So there's this one place I was at. They were hanging out with the tigers. And the commissary is where you prepare the food. And it's a little gory, but, you know, tigers got to eat. So if you don't get chicken donated from Tyson or some other big organization, you usually have to butcher a cow. And, you know, let me just put it to you this way. It was vile going in there. I don't even think their refrigerator worked.
Oh, God.
And that's sort of the things that we uncover with the roadside zoos. So, you know, you have defecating food everywhere on an unclean floor, feces in the enclosure. So it can be as bad as a lot of these activists say it is, but it's not in an AZA facility. Every single enclosure gets completely cleaned out at least once a day.
Yeah.
And when I say cleaned out, sanitized, scrub, etc. So
good.
Yeah.
I like that answer. So my last question is totally not important at all. And I feel like I kind of already know the answer, but what is your absolute favorite animal?
Oof.
You gotta choose one.
Yeah.
No top three or anything.
Get out of here, black-footed ferrets, you slobs.
Probably lions, because they would eat the black-footed ferret.
That works.
Yeah, no, lions are, I've always been my favorite. It's just so weird, but thank God it's part of my job description. I love watching animals intensely, and there's something about the social behavior of lions that are fascinating. And when you talk about an animal, you see on these shows all the time, I mean, they'll be like, they'll have their jaws broken and still survive another 2 years. So they're absolutely incredible.
Just robust. I will say they are beautiful creatures and very, very loud.
I want to go to a zoo so bad now in an aquarium.
Dude, we walked into the zoo and there was this noise, like this guttural noise coming from across the park. And I was like, what the heck is that, an elephant or something? Looked on the map, there's no elephants. So we walk over to the lion enclosure and it was the lion.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's incredible. I love zoos.
You should add that sound effect in there.
The lion sound effect? Yeah.
Well, a lot of people like the MGM logo, like when the lion's coming up, and they're like, oh, the lion's roaring, but like technically that's not a roar. What you heard is a roar.
Yeah, yeah. I tried to convince my daughter that it was a meow. That didn't really work. She's only two, so like, we're like, what do cats say? And she's like, meow. So I was trying to be like, what did the lion say? Meow. No, it's roar.
How about you two? What are your favorite animals?
Mine, I already said it before, is definitely the red panda.
Right.
They're so adorable. And then there's like always videos online of them playing with each other. And they got like these giant paws and these cute little faces. Like, I like how your answer was like actually qualified with something. Mine is, they're cute.
Yeah. They are cute.
I'd probably stick with some kind of dog, like a husky. I've got two huskies.
So a domesticated animal?
Domesticated. If I'm going to go undomesticated, fine for you guys.
Yeah.
Wolf.
Or tardigrade. Equal. I like them both. They have different qualities. Tardigrades are like cute little water bears that can survive in space. And wolves, they don't survive in space, but they'll eat your face.
I did see a wolf in person at the Minnesota Zoo, and I was actually really surprised. Like, I'd obviously never seen one in real life. They're like so made for killing. They're like so lean and huge, and
yeah,
those are beautiful creatures as well.
I think it's time to go. If I you ever I mean, I think it's time to go to the zoo.
Oh.
Now,
yeah.
That'd be a fun trip.
Yeah.
And if I always think of what's my perfect, like, if you're going to meditate and you picture a perfect moment or a perfect place, there's something so relaxing about aquariums, too. Mm-hmm. Just the light reflecting and all that.
Yeah.
It just
makes
me want to go even more.
Yeah. I love aquarium, but that's another episode.
Yeah.
We'll talk about aquariums another time. I think that'll do it for us today, unless either of you have anything else.
This has been a pleasure, and like
Absolutely.
I said, thanks for having me on the show. And you know, I really was excited to work with you guys for the amount of research that you do, and for being real about a lot of these sensitive issues, presenting the facts. That's all you can do, and a lot of these issues are not black and white.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know?
Yeah,
they're wicked.
They are wicked.
They're wicked hard.
Yeah, no, we appreciate you coming on.
We'd love to have you on again, for
exactly.
sure.
We gotta like do Absolutely. A whole episode on animal welfare, because now I'm just like, I need to know more about this. So mm-hmm.
that book is a great resource for everybody. You'll definitely be like, the one last thing, what people don't realize when we study animal behavior, we're talking clinical trials, and we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of serious experiments. And no, not like, you know, I'm going to stick this chimpanzee with a needle.
Right.
You know, a lot of it is observed. The type of research that I did was looking at different species and their ability to discriminate between two objects. And if they got it right, they got it. You know what I mean? So our knowledge has come really far. And unfortunately, there is a huge gap between what we learn and what gets out there to the public.
Hey, that's what we're here for. Try to get as many people educated as we can. So it's been fun.
Yep.
Absolutely.
I'm still John.
I'm still Nick.
Sometimes I'm Dave.
And this is Stranger Still.